Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome back our next guest, Porik Okeji. It would take me all day to list all of Porik's achievements, all of the businesses he's run, everything that he's achieved. So in an attempt to hit the highlights to set the stage, in his career, Porik has been a teacher, a lawyer, a serial entrepreneur, a politician, and now an author. He is likely most recognized for purchasing a failing airline and turning it into a wild success story. That led him to become Ernst & Young's Entrepreneur of the Year for all of Ireland, a finalist for all of Europe, and eventually on the board and committee for choosing the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year for Europe. He was an Irish senator, and during his time in politics, he applied his skills to pass a perjury bill unanimously across all parties. He is a mentor to many, including, thankfully, myself, and author of his new book, Purposeful Decision-Making. Even with the time I've been fortunate enough to spend with Porik, his book blew my expectations away. And I am so excited that he took the time to join us from Ireland to have a conversation and share not only the lessons from, but the stories behind his new book. I'm really excited to share this with everybody today. He's going to get into topics like breaking down the anatomy of good and bad decisions. He's going to define what safe harbor means and why it is so important for all of us. He's going to talk about the difference between information and knowledge and how to turn information into knowledge. For me, I was really intrigued to dive into the conversation of understanding the difference between teaching and facilitating learning. And he's going to wrap a lot of these lessons around stories from his business career, including turning around that aforementioned airline that we talked about. I'm so excited to share this with you. Thank you all for being here once again for another conversation. We truly appreciate it. Before you go, take a second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show. We really appreciate you coming back week after week. Let's also take a brief moment to thank our sponsors. Check out the show notes after and visit humantel.com. That's where you can learn more about developing the scientific back skills to recognize when people's emotions are shifting by recognizing changes in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. If you're a professional interviewer, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to learn all you need to know about the International Association of Interviewers and the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And while you're online, check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to obtain the everyday confessions hiding in all of their high-value conversations. We really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. So let's get right to it. I now introduce to you, Porik Okeji. Porik, it is so amazing to see you. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be here. Again, how are you?
Mike, it's a great, great pleasure to see you. It's a long number of years since we first met in Chicago. And since then, we've become really good friends. We haven't met too often afterwards, but you know, I'm across the other side of the Atlantic and the friendships is as strong as ever, thank God. And thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this podcast and this program.
It is my pleasure. I say this to people all the time. When people ask me, how did I get to where I am or how did I get to where I'm doing? I don't end up where I am today without you. And it starts with the conversation that we had in your family's pub in Chicago.
That's right.
It extended to the conversation we had in your car driving from Galway to Dublin. Then the conversations that we had in the hotel the first time we worked together in Dublin. But after that first trip to Dublin, I started writing out ideas on my flight home for what would eventually become my business based on our conversation. So thank you for your friendship, your guidance. I can't thank you enough.
Michael, that's the single biggest privilege a person can have, or the single biggest accolade you can offer somebody, Because if I can feel, which I do after what you're saying, that I can make a difference in somebody's life, that's better than a gold medal at the Olympics. That's amazing. And the more we, and all of you who are watching and listening to this podcast, the more you can do that, the better and deeper and more satisfying your life will be. So let's continue to do our best to make a difference, a positive difference in people's lives. And thank you very much.
Thank you. And speaking of amazing, your book is amazing. When I got an email that said you were publishing your book, I wanted to knock over Amazon's building, find out the best way to get it now. I couldn't wait. It was like a kid who just found out his favorite toy was available. And I just couldn't wait till Christmas to get it. And my expectations were exceeded when I sat down to read it. It's The Purposeful Decision Maker, correct? I got the title correct?
That's it, yeah.
I'm always nervous to quote a title. I'm afraid I'm just going to get it wrong. But the whole book, how it's laid out step by step, and even little things, you have the purpose of each chapter on the title page of each chapter, like talking about practicing what you preach and living what you do. When I get to the title, I get to the table of contents, I get to the first chapter, I'm like, he's not playing around. There it is. There's the purpose. So what I would love to do with the limited time that we have today, and I know you're taking time out of your evening to have this conversation, is I would love to ask you some questions, dive a little bit deeper into a few areas of the book, and really turn people on to the insight, the experiences, the ideas, so much that's in the book that people can apply to everyday life. I was telling you before we hit record that when I got it, I took it out of the envelope, I was flipping through it, and my thumb happened to land on the title of a chapter. And as soon as I saw it, I said, ooh, I need this. And the title of the chapter was Anatomy of a Good Decision, one way or the other. So yeah. I would love it if we could please start the conversation by asking you to walk us through the anatomy of a good decision.
Absolutely. So first of all, you can have a good decision, and for factors outside of your control, you may not get a great answer or get what you're looking for. And you can make a poor decision, and it can work out for you. So it can. So not every good or great decision works exactly as you want. That's life. Life is not perfect. So an anatomy of a good or a great decision, there are a number of factors in it. One factor is you need to just step back and don't let emotions drive your decision-making, because that means that you're not necessarily looking at the whole picture. You may not be taking the facts of the situation into account and the effects of it totally into account. So I'm not saying that emotions isn't good. Emotions are great. But when you're making a big decision, there are a number of factors you need to take into account. And certainly emotion is one of them, but not the only factor. You got to look and say, what are the key ingredients here? What do I want to achieve? That's why we call it the purposeful decision maker. What is the purpose? Start out with the purpose. What do you want to achieve? And connected with the purpose is what I call your safe harbor. And your safe harbor, Mike, I think in pictures, so I'll be probably describing it a little bit in pictures, and I hope you and the viewers are okay with that. But I'm asking your viewers to close their eyes and get a blank sheet of paper and draw a circle in that blank sheet of paper. And call that your safe harbor or your secure base, whichever you want. Same thing. And the most important element of that safe harbor are the people who are in it. And you ask yourself, are the people who are in it, are they the people that should be in it? Maybe somebody shouldn't be there 5, 10 years ago, but maybe not now. Maybe there's people who are not in it who should be in it. So do a little bit of interrogation on that. Do a bit of interrogation on your purpose in life. Where are you going? What do you want to achieve? Do a little bit of interrogation into you yourself. What kind of a person are you? What motivates you? What drives you? When you have that done, then you look at, okay, what decision do I have to make here? Why do I have to make it? What do I want to achieve? And is it going to be aligned with my safe harbor? Is it going to strengthen my safe harbor, or could it weaken my safe harbor? So there are a small number of key elements in your safe harbor. Let's just give an example. Take the idea of you're thinking of buying a house. And you'd say, okay, these are my boundaries around which I'm buying the house. This is the location I'm looking for. This is why, because I have young children, I need them to be here at such and such a school. These are the type of schools I'd like them to go to. There's the shops and shopping centers that need around that. Like, I actually do my work from around it. They're all the factors that are actually important in you actually making a sound and good decision. And the key aspect of it is what you can afford, the financial side of it. So you get in, take into account all those key factors that actually create the boundaries around which you'll be making your decision. And then you would say, which houses fit inside those boundaries? And then which one of those houses fits best into my secure base or safe harbor? So there's a methodology, Mike, through making a decision and making a good decision, or actually making a better decision and reducing the risk of making a poor decision. There are other factors in it as well. And actually, this goes back to, you know, I owned an airline for 26 years. Started an airline, built it up, and so on. And like, if there's one word that you would regard as, what's the single most important word in aviation? Or what's the single most important word in your business? Or you, the person who's watching and listening to this, what is the most important word in your work or in your business? Think that through. It might take a while. So we were looking at building an airline, wanted to get good positive cash flow, get as many passengers as we could, try and minimize competition, obviously, if we could, because that was reducing our financial risk and so on. What do you think was the single most important word? In
safety.
100%. 100%. Safety is the most important word in aviation. Because if you don't have a safe airline, you're not going to get passengers that don't trust you. You're up there in an aluminium tube, 30,000 feet in the air, trusting two people that you've never met, you've never spoken to. You don't have their mobile telephone numbers to bring you from A to B, not only safely, and you want to enjoy the trip. That is serious trust. And the only way that trust comes in there is if the whole company is focused, number one, on safety. So, think of Captain Sully going into the Hudson River. And how that brave, fantastic pilot, captain, decided in a split second, this is the decision I'm making. And his focus was on what's the least amount of damage or hurt that he could cause to his co-pilots and staff and passengers and for people on the ground. What are my options here? And he went for the one that would potentially cause the minimum amount of injury. And everybody got saved. Now, the most important thing about safety in aviation, single most important thing, is decision making. As I said, with an airline for, I owned an airline for 26 years with up to 900 flights a week. We never had one accident. Touch wood, thank God. And that was primarily down my focus. was creating the space and the environment within which my team, my staff, would make the best decisions they could, given whatever circumstances they were in. Mightn't always work out 100%, but at least, and I trusted them. So I created the environment and the training for them to actually go and make the best decisions they could. And as many people know, medicine, medical consultants, surgeons, they've actually, hospitals, they've looked to aviation and said, what do you guys do? Let's learn from you so we minimize mistakes we make when we're carrying out surgeries. So that's one part of it. Also, Mike, just you mentioned that time we drove from Galway in the west of Ireland to Dublin and the workshop, the brilliant workshop they gave to YPO people from all over Europe and actually Northern Africa as well. That was called the hidden truth. And what that was about is helping people like me, entrepreneurs, business people, and so on. Can you actually see through? And what's the connection between what people say and how people act? And is there a synergy there? So that's helping me. You are helping me and all the other people on that program to make better decisions, to be more observant. And a critical part of all of that is being able to listen actively. Big difference between listen actively and listen passively. Listen passively is kind of going over your head. Yeah, I'll hear what you're saying. And hearing what somebody is saying and listening to what they're saying is chalk and cheese. So that was the background to the book. Looking at how decisions are made in aviation, I've also mentored or coached Olympic athletes and high-performing athletes in Ireland. And so how they make split decisions when they have to make them very quickly. Well, that's it. They got to naturally and instinctively react in certain ways. So there is a training, there's a mental training and practice in order to be able to go and do that. Also, a very good friend of mine is a person called Jim Gavin, probably the most successful Gaelic football coach ever in Ireland. Dublin, his team won the All-Ireland final five times in a row, which was totally unheard of. Jim would be one of the top aviation risk analysts in the world, one of the top five in the world. And Jim and I often talked about this. And I mentioned it in the book, OOTA, O-O-T-A, with Captain Boyd, who was an American Air Force pilot. And models like that are in the book to help you decipher and decide and analyze and critique your decision-making process. And it's not an overnight thing. It's like going to the gym. First time you go there, you'll find it kind of difficult. I wake up the following morning with pains in your muscles and your legs and so on. Second time you go, it's a little bit easier. Third time, it's a little bit easier. And you know, Mike, if you keep going, after 6 or 12 months, you'll be quite fit and you'll be pretty active and you'll be very happy with yourself. Decision-making is a process as well that you learn. And the whole idea behind it is, and I was delighted that you mentioned there at the beginning of our conversation, that you mentioned that, like, I have up there at the very, very top of every chapter what the purpose is of that chapter. What's its purpose? And that is really fundamental and the whole process. But the book is about, it's really intended to be kind of a workbook for the reader to ask and challenge themselves in relation to where they're at in their decision-making, where they're going to go, to reflect on past decisions, ones that worked, ones that didn't work. And sometimes the ones that didn't work, don't beat yourself up because of it. Because a lot of them are due to factors outside of your control, right? You worked on the best available information at the time. there is stuff that happens that you have no control over, and that changes the goalposts. Think of the recession that we all went through in 2008, 9, 10, 11, and 12, that type of thing, you know. So we didn't see that coming, and decisions we made before that may well have been different if we had seen that coming. So that's a long-winded way to answer a very straightforward question.
Now, I love it and I appreciate it. And when you talk about the process, and I won't steal from the book, I promise, but you even talk about thinking in pictures, illustrate the funnel of how we take that initial information and we check it with internal sources and external sources, and we refine it into knowledge, and then that knowledge into action. So in aligning all that around our safe harbor, you tricked me into highlighting two different diagrams, because the first one didn't have purpose in safe harbor, but the second one did.
Exactly.
And you mentioned the workbook aspect of it at the end of each chapter. There is the questions to reflect on, the note space to take the notes. And for me, one of the things that I took from it, and we were talking a little bit about my business prior to hitting record and starting this conversation, is, you know, I'm at a flexion point where I'm making different decisions and doing different things. So now I can take the framework that you laid out and apply it to decisions that I'm currently in the process of considering and making, which selfishly I found very timely and completely appropriate. So thank you for that.
Right.
When I was reading the book, one of the things that I was not surprised to see was the very next chapter was Anatomy of Bad Decisions. Knowing you as I've got to know you and your humility and how you share your whole story with people, I wasn't surprised that despite all of your success owning multiple companies and in politics and coaching and mentoring and everything, that you still took the time to share mistakes or decisions you'd like to have back or examples that you learn from. So we talked a little bit about making good decisions. What are some of the common mistakes or missed opportunities that lead people to making bad decisions?
One is not stepping back and reflecting in relation to what are the consequences of my decision. And there's a very, I did not come up with this, but it's a well-known diagram called the Johari window.
Yes.
Johari window is really important in maybe addressing the question you asked there, Mike. And Johari window is, if you look at the top, there's you across the top, broken into four segments. And on the left-hand side, then, is other people. So the first segment is information you know and other people know. The second quadrant, which is to the right of it, is what you know and other people don't know. The third quadrant is what other people know and you don't know. And the fourth quadrant is what none of you know. And you have to try and maximize the amount of information that you know in order to help you make the decision. And it's really helpful if you can actually talk to the right people. A number of times where I've made bad decisions, I went and I took advice from people who really didn't know what they were talking about or who had particular agendas to set me on a particular track. They had some financial or other benefit out of it, which I wasn't necessarily aware of at the time. So put yourself in the shoes of the other person you're going to ask their opinion on and say, look, what's in it for them? Why would they be biased? Bias is a big part, and there's a chapter on it. Would they have a bias in some way or a filter in the information they're giving me or sharing with me? So I've made lots of mistakes. I took advice from people who I thought was good people, but was bad advice. They had particular agendas, which wasn't necessarily in my best interest. And I leveraged or gave too much weight to those decisions. The other thing you mentioned also that's really important, Michael, you mentioned the funnel, the diagram of the funnel. And it dawned on me a long, long time ago in business, Like in aviation, I just wanted every day that we just had no more than like five fingers up there, no more than five pieces of information that's critical for my business. So what would be the 2, 3, 4, or 5 critical pieces of information for you and your business or everybody who's listening? Just think that through. In aviation, what's really important is on-time performance. What percentage of our flights are on time? I asked my marketing team once, I'll never forget. I asked them, what are we selling here in the airline? They're selling good quality flights, enjoyment, relaxation, friendly staff, bring you from A to B, all that type of thing. You know, the only real thing we're doing is assuming fundamentally that safety is there. And you never assume that because that's your big area. But the only thing we're selling, the only thing that airlines sell is time. The reason you go on an airplane to go from A to B is that you'll get there much, much faster, or you should, by walking, cycling, going by car, or going by train. That's it. So if you know what you're, if you don't know what you're selling, how do you think the customer is going to try and understand or figure out what you're selling? So decide what you're selling, because if that's the purpose of marketing, to understand what they're selling and then to sell and market that. But you first must understand what you're selling. Now, the reason I'm saying that also, back to the funnel, there's a huge difference between information and knowledge. Information, we know, on the tips of our fingers, we never had as much information ever in the world of mankind or womankind or anybody. Never as much information. And that information is like a tsunami. What do we do with it? How can we trust it to make a decision? So the purpose of the funnel is to change information or help us change information into knowledge. And knowledge is deciding what information is useful. Are we happy with the source of that information, where it's coming from? How can we use that knowledge to help us make a better decision? So you're funneling out a lot of irrelevant information and narrowing it down to the core information that's really important for you to make decisions. You're filtering it down and you're taking stuff like bias out of it, or stuff that's not really relevant out of it, in order to say, these are the key factors. Like I said, back to aviation, on-time performance is critical. People, biggest reason people complain is because flights are delayed, and rightly so, because somebody's supposed to meet me at O'Hare Airport at 6 o'clock. It's 9 o'clock at night now. What's the story here? I'm stuck on the airplane in the tarmac or in wherever, you know. That's why people get really annoyed and mad and cross, and rightly so. On-time performance is critically important. That's our level of performance. There are some factors that are outside of your control, like weather. And that's fine, because that's a safety issue. So it is. I will never compromise safety. The other factor then, for me, was really important, was what's our percentage load factor? In other words, what percentage of our airplane is full? I needed 60%, well, 59% of every flight full. In other words, I could get away with 41% of the seats empty and I would break even. And I knew then for every percentage above 59%, how much of a profit I was making. I did not have to wait for my accountant at the end of the month to come back to me with the monthly accounts and say, this is the money we made last month. Didn't need that. I get a text message every day to say what the load factor was the previous day. We're on. I know what level of complaints we're going to get if we had all our flights on time. or if there was 5% of them delayed more than 15 minutes. I also knew straight what profit or loss we were making based on the load factor for that particular day. Another factor that's very important is the number of rotations your airplane does in a day. And the big thing about that is the more rotations it does, the harder it's working and the more you can make money, because in aviation, it's huge cost in aviation. Like the airplanes we were using brand new were about $30 million each. So you had to utilize those airplanes. An airplane on the ground is not making money for you. An airplane in the air, you have some chance of it making money for you. So that was another key factor. At one stage, Michael, and I moved away from aviation, I set up a newspaper in the Gaelic language, the main Gaelic language newspaper in Ireland at the time. And I could go into the shop. It was weekly, come out every Saturday morning. I'd buy the newspaper for a euro or whatever it was. And in about less than a minute, I'd know what profit or loss we met that day, because I knew how many pages of advertising I needed to break even. So let's say, for example, I needed 6 pages of advertising to break even. I knew what, if it was 5 pages, I'd have lost $1,500. If it was 7 pages, I'd have made $1,000. If it was 8 pages, I'd made $2,500. I didn't have to wait for my accountant to tell me. Because you cannot procrastinate on decision-making. Because if you do, sometimes, pardon the pun, you could miss the boat. Or the tide has gone out. Timing is really, really important. But the difference between information and knowledge is critical in making a good decision.
And you talk in the book many times, and you just gave several great examples on the simplicity of making decisions. What are those 5 factors? What's going to tell me what I need to know the fastest? Might not need to know down to the penny or the specifics, but it gives me enough to make the right decision and move. And you even gave examples of, I might not need to make the perfect decision. The perfect decision might not even be available, but I need to make the best choice based on what I have now, on my purpose and safe harbor and the context that's available. And I'm stealing from your book a little bit here, so I apologize in advance, but I feel like a little clip that I read is just so emblematic of how I've gotten to know you over time. When you mentioned the flights being delayed, you mentioned in the book how, yeah, the delay is the problem, but it wasn't really the delay. It was a lack of communication around the delay that really is what set people off. And it was your daughter that accidentally gave you the solution to solve the problem based on watching her go through a completely unrelated event. And I won't steal all the details. People have to read the book to get that. But again, given your family, not only giving your family credit for it, which is true, but also what I love, it's another example when you talk about refining information into knowledge, where you took 2 things that were seemingly completely unrelated. But because your radar is always on, the contextual awareness is always there, you're constantly seeking that knowledge, you were able to take 2 things that might be completely unrelated to most people and say, there's the solution to one of my biggest problems. And we're going to be, I believe, the first airline in order to employ this, in order to solve our issue. So I'm going to use that to jump to my next question that I took from your book. What are some things that we can do to revolutionize how we all make decisions?
I'm going to give you a kind of an unusual answer to that.
Please.
The best thing we can do is to learn and practice mindfulness. Because mindfulness helps us clear our head, create space. It allows us to become much more aware of the environment, and an awareness of what's relevant and what's not relevant, what's important and not important. And the less mindful we are, usually, the more that's going on outside our heads that comes back into our heads, the less space we have to have clear, pure processing of decisions and information. So in my view, it's mindfulness. Now, part to me of mindfulness is it's not just looking after your mind and what's in the top 6 inches. It's also looking after your body. It's not just a mental thing. It's a physical thing and a mental thing. So you say, okay, I love walking a mountain trail. I love swimming. I love going out in a boat. That is mindfulness, because that actually connects the physical side and the mental side of your body. When you actually start moving into that space, you develop so much more clarity. There's another story there, Michael. I don't know, maybe should I tell it or not? Because I grew up speaking a different language, not English. I grew up speaking Gaelic, because the part of Ireland I come from is pretty poor, very working class, and almost everybody emigrated. Rangton is a good Irish name too, by the way, as you know.
County Roscommon, I believe.
Roscommon, exactly. There's East Galway, Roscommon. And there's a huge number of Americans, and I'm sure a lot of people listening, who can trace back their roots to Irishness, or it could be any other country, and that's fine. But I had an uncle, and he became a Jesuit priest, and he had to learn English. He went to Oakland, just north of San Francisco, northeast of San Francisco. And they, Jesuits sent them out to China in, it was around the 1670s. And he was captured because he was promoting Christianity and the Catholic faith. And he was put into prison there, and he was in solitary confinement for over a year. Nobody knew where he was. The Chinese in the end threw him out of prison because they couldn't break him. I remember when I was about 10 or 11, he was reading mass in a country, small country church, probably about 15 miles away from where I'm speaking to you now, further west, overlooking Galway Bay. And there are no microphones, but he was a tall, thin man. He didn't look well. And he was speaking in a low voice, and I was in the second row, and there would have been probably 50 or 60 people in the church. And I'll never forget what he said. I was only 10 or so, 10 or 11. He said, I was in a prison cell that was about 8 foot by 8 foot. And there was a small window up at the top. I couldn't reach it. But I knew by looking up at the window and the light, it was daytime or nighttime. And sometimes I could see some stars through that window. And he said he imagined that he was walking up the road in Spittle, which the local village here for me, it's a small little tiny little village. There's a whole lot of peat and bogland and so on around us. And he would actually, in his mind, call into the various small little farmers and fishermen's houses. And he'd sit down and have a conversation with them. And in his mind, he'd have a cup of tea with them. No coffee out here at that time, or cappuccinos or anything like that. Far from that, we were reared. And sometimes it's summertime, sometimes it's wintertime, sometimes they're cutting peat and turf, sometimes they're going out fishing, various things. And they were unable to break them in the prison. And I'll never forget what he said. I was in a physical prison, but my mind was not in a prison. And he said, the worst, most difficult prison you could ever be in is the prison you create in your own head. And that is where, when you start using mindfulness, looking after yourself, your body, giving life your best shot, valuing people and community, that's when you're really, really living and living your purposeful life. And it's on that space you can make you can make really, really good decisions. And when your head is clouded and your body is not being given the energy that it wants and craves and needs, that's when you start making clouded decisions that are not necessarily the best decisions for you. So it's back in my mind, which probably is a strange answer, but to mindfulness.
Well, I don't think it's a strange answer at all. And you point out in your book that people can achieve mindfulness in many different ways, which I certainly agree with. And I think the story you shared is also an extremely powerful example of safe harbor, because he was able to take himself back to his safe harbor and keep himself there, at least mentally, in order to get through an extremely trying experience, one that I couldn't begin to understand or narrate.
Yeah. No, that's a great way, Michael, of pulling it together. You're 100%. That's it. Yeah.
As we've got to know each other over the years, it's in even reading that story and a couple other places in the book, you talk about where that you were from. Little things tend to strike me about people. And one of the things that struck me about you is how often I heard you say the phrase, Connemara, where I'm from, the first week or so in total. It was over separate occasions, but probably the first like 6 to 7 days we ever spent together, whether you're talking to me or somebody else or addressing a group, Connemara, where I'm from, that phrase. And I do believe that most people should be proud of where they're from and who that has made them. But it struck me the degree of pride and experience and how your heritage has helped you become who you are and help you help other people who they've become as well along the way, which is a very long-winded way to tie an old observation into a new question. One of the things you talked about in your book was you decided to get a PhD on yourself.
Yeah, that was an interesting journey. It took me a long time to get there, though.
If I started now, I'm not sure I'd ever do it. But
of course they would.
Ever complete it, I should say. But I'm very curious, what led you to make that decision? And I guess looking back on it, what were some of the biggest lessons or takeaways that really influenced your life from that process?
The PhD I was talking about is the most important PhD anyone will ever do. It's not an academic PhD you'll get out of any university, or research you'll do by going into the Baker Library in Harvard and reading up and learning about something. The best and most important PhD any of us will ever do is get to understand who we are as individuals. Who am I really? What kind of a person am I? What motivates me? What demotivates me? What are the kind of people I love being around who give me energy? Back to safe harbor. Am I spending time with people who are actually dragging my energy, dragging me down? That's not the space I need to be in. So learn and inquisitively learn about yourself in relation to really, really, really who am I as a person. And just after reading your book, Michael, and it's out for a while, one of the best books I've ever read in my life. It's called, you may well be know it, The Boys in the Boat. And I would highly recommend it to everybody who's listening and watching, to consider getting that book. And there's a movie out as well by the same name, but read the book first. And the reason I'm saying this, it speaks directly to or this part of our conversation. And I'm not going to tell the whole story, but these were very working class people during the big recession in US, in your country. And they started coming together and started rowing. And rowing would have been very much kind of an elite sport for were very wealthy people and so on. And they actually used, where they came from, very working class, they used that as a source of energy. And they never, ever, ever pretended to be somebody that they weren't. Even though they were rowing against some of the best schools in America and other places, I'm not going to tell the story, some of you may well have read it. And to me, where I come from is the starting point of my PhD journey. And it's so, so important that you accept who you are and where you come from. We're all really, really special. We're very unique people. And another way, we're no more unique than anybody else. And it's important to not only be aware about that, but to feel blessed that we are like that. And some of us face, all of us face different challenges in life. Sometimes we have smaller challenges, sometimes we have huge challenges. That's life. In Buddhism, they call it dukkha. And it's really important to accept that, because life throws those things to you, throws curveballs to you. And probably one of the biggest things I would have loved to have taught my children is resilience. As well as doing a PhD on yourself, helping you to make better decisions. Like, I can't understand, Michael, that I spent probably, 20 years, 25 years in school. Not once did any teacher ever sit me down or sit a class down and say, this is how you make decisions. And probably the most important thing in the world is the decisions you make. The journey you take in this world, you go this way or that way, or no way. No way is procrastinating. Are the decisions you make. Nobody ever taught us that. We kind of have to learn it and work it going along. I believe that decision making should be taught to every teenager in the country, quite frankly. And to support them and challenge them and ask them, what kind of decisions do you make? Why do you need to make them? Where's your safe harbor? I think we'd have a better world if that was the situation.
I agree. And as a father of a young son, it's something that I do struggle with. How to teach people to, the words that I use to him that might not always be the best, or, be your own man, think for yourself. Do the right thing. We give different examples in different situations, depending on what he deals with in the day, but working through things, not quitting, not giving in. It's not necessarily about the end result, the process we use to get there. I know there are ways, but if the school system embraced ways to structurally teach that, I think that could pay huge dividends. Speaking of teaching, you spent a large part of your career in many stages in many different ways, including formally in classrooms as a teacher. And you were asking me some questions before we hit record, because if I didn't hit record, you and I would have been talking until it was well past your bedtime and my bedtime. And honestly, in many ways, I see myself as a teacher. For better or worse, people can agree or disagree. But if, outside of the importance of taking care of my family professionally, I would see myself as a teacher. And reading your book, there was a section that struck me that I had to go back and read a few times. So I would be grateful if you could take a moment and walk us through the power and the difference that you have learned between teaching and facilitating learning.
Wow. I'm taken aback by your observation of that and the importance of that. I mean, it's fundamental. First of all, I started life after college as an accountant with KPMG, a large accountancy firm. And I realized, this was decision making, I was in my early 20s, that accountancy was not for me. I didn't want to be working in an office just pressing calculators with numbers. And I decided that what I really liked was people, working with people. And one day I bumped into my old headmaster and he said, "Warwick, what do you do now?" I said, "I'm an accountant." He said, "Do you ever think of teaching? I think you'd be a good teacher." I said, "I'll try it out." So I tried it out. And I modeled myself, first of all, Michael, because I was teaching in the school that I was a student in. I modeled myself on who I felt was the best teacher who taught me. He was still teaching there. And this is important for all of us. Do you model yourself on somebody else? Which is fine. That's important. That got me from there, maybe up there. My quality of teaching improved. Because life is a journey and teaching is same as life. It's a journey. And then I said, how can I become a better teacher? Anything I've ever done, I give it my best shot. And I don't fear failure when I give it my best shot. I get annoyed at myself when I fail, when I didn't give it my best shot. So I realized that if I introduce my own personality into the classroom, into teaching, actually I can engage better with the students rather than saying, what would this teacher do in this situation? Let me try and think what he'd do and I'll do the same. And I really enjoyed that. And then I realized I actually went to the UK and went to America. This is 30, 35 years ago, to learn about latest teaching methods. And I came across a program called the Silva Method, a book 30, 35 years ago. No emails. I sent them a letter. Never thought I'd get a reply, and I did. I said, can I do a course on this? This is a guy in Mexico or Texas who actually self-taught his own kids, and they did really, really well in education. And he told me that, or they told me that there was a guy in Limerick in Ireland who was actually a qualified teacher of it. So I went and I learned, I trained under him. And I realized, Mike, that teaching was not what I was supposed to do. Teaching is the wrong term. Teaching is instructing, telling people what to do. But my role was to facilitate learning, just as you said. Facilitate learning is looking through the barrel from the other side with a different lens. So facilitating learning means you're creating the environment within which people can learn. That's really important for me in the structure of the book. That structure of the book was created in such a way to help readers facilitate the learning of their decision-making style. So you're creating the environment within which people can learn. You give them the broad parameters. Say, I used to teach mathematics mainly, for example. You're doing calculus. There's 5 or 6 different formulas. So you get them and you share them with them. And actually you end up getting the students to write their own homework questions. Then you get the students to actually work in small groups to help facilitate learning for each other. And it was going really, really well. And I loved it. And you know something? They were, I'll use the term, teaching each other. So I was able to little bit step back and be there and trust their decision-making in supporting each other's in the learning. And I realized then, wow, they remember. I used to get my students to write their own mathematics book. Each student had their own mathematics book. Because some students learn visually. Others learn kinesthetically by feeling and touching and so on. And some are very strong auditory, so they would be good at music and listening and all that. They can interpret that. So worked on that and was really, really enjoyable. But also for me, the time I spent teaching was a fundamental block, I mean, positive block, stepping stone and actually starting and creating and building a business, because I won Ireland's EY Entrepreneur of the Year, represented Ireland the World Entrepreneur of the Year, didn't win that. I was a judge for the world for a couple of years afterwards. I chaired the judging panel in Ireland for about 8 years or more. I've seen thousands of business plans. I've never seen a company grow in my life. Company do not grow. People grow. So what you do in your business is you create the environment within which your people can learn and grow. Give them the space, give them the support, give them the beliefs that you believe in them, that they can actually grow and develop. So what started off with my vision, they take it over. Then they take ownership of it. Now it's their vision. Now they're climbing to the top of the hill or the mountain with the flag. And that's where their passion comes in, because they own it as parting who they are. And that to me is a sign of a great leader, if you can do that, because the best leadership, best leaders lead from behind. They create other people around them as leaders. So that's what I was trying to do in my teaching and facilitating learning, getting them to be able to teach and lead each other, give them the self-belief that they've got the talent and the ability and the brain power to learn and do whatever they want.
And that self-belief ties back into the parenting comment you made earlier, instilling that in our children and our youth, giving them the self-belief that they can grow and they can believe and they can overcome as well. There were many points in the book where I stopped and smiled. I thought about a story that you had shared with me previously, or learned a little bit more about you, that the decision-making funnel and turning that into an outline for me to follow with some decisions coming up. But when I read the piece about the facilitating learning, you know, so much of what I do is teaching, and that really caused me to take a step back and rethink, grow, how to evolve and maybe adapt, probably not everything, but pieces and opportunities for how to improve what I'm doing. I could honestly ask you questions and talk to you all night. I've never had a conversation with you where I haven't been taking notes and walked away from it benefiting more certainly than anything I could have given during the conversation. I know it's late where you are, and I'm truly grateful for you sharing this time at the end of what certainly was already a long day for you. So to wrap this up, I'll save a couple more questions for another time. Where can people find out more about you and your book? For those that are listening, they want to learn from you, they want to connect with you, they want to read the book, where do they need to go?
Okay. Books on Amazon, first of all. Secondly, the publishers of an American company called Amplify. So doing a Google search on Amplify, you'll get them on Amplify. The publishers are working through a distributor to have it available in places like Barnes & Noble and so on. And the other thing, if people want to just Google my name, I haven't done it yet. I'm just at the latter stages of creating a website, a direct website that people can connect with me. In actual fact, Michael, the interest in the book has taken me aback. I did not expect anything like the interest that there is in the book. It was number one Amazon bestseller in its first week in November. Ran out of printed versions very quickly. So it's available now on Amazon Print on Demand, which is kind of an easier, more effective way, rather than saying, okay, we're out of print, we got to print more, print another 1,000 or whatever it is. And that's it. Probably Amazon and Amplify are at the current page, two best ways to go and get the book. But it's always a real pleasure talking to you, meeting you, seeing you. And I wish I had done. Do you know, sometimes I was so busy in the airline, and you know, some decisions, sometimes you regret. That she said, "Well, I wish I'd gone to your wedding."
Oh. Well, you were at my wedding in spirit.
I was, and you invited me to your wedding. And I just, you know, when you're, my head is in the cloud and I'm trying to say, I need to do this with the airline, I need to do that, I need to do the other. But anyway, well, that's us.
I appreciate that, but you were there in spirit. One of the things that has been, I don't know the right way to say it, it's always humbling and I'm always appreciative when I go different places or I meet with different groups and they give me a small gift at the end of whatever the event is. I mean, quite frankly, people are paying me to be there. So that's more than enough gift, you know, to be a part of it. But there's been times where I've been places and people have given me gifts. They tend to fall in pretty common categories. Some have been a little bit more thoughtful than others. But the first time you and I worked together, I still never figured out. You would think the investigator in me would have figured this out, but I just let the mystery live. At the end of that engagement, you stood up in front of the group and you said some nice things, which I was very grateful about. But you announced to the group that you had ascertained my date of birth. So kudos to you for doing that. But that, and again, to get back to Connemara, that you had gone to one of your contacts in Connemara. If I'm saying it right, I apologize, because now I'm getting a little choked up because this honestly meant a lot to me. And this was before we really got to know each other, that you had two custom cufflinks made for me with Irish pennies from the year I was born.
That's right.
And to this day, those are among my, honestly, they're among my most valuable possessions because of the sentimental attachment that I have. But I, when my wife and I got married, I specifically went out and purchased a shirt with French cuffs.
Oh my God.
And I wore those cufflinks at our wedding. So
I was very much...
So you were there. You were there in spirit. You played a role. And one of these days, I will bring my family to Ireland, I promise.
Absolutely.
And when brilliant. I do, you will meet
and
them.
I will be there big time.
You will see how I am, without a doubt, the luckiest man on the planet with my wife and son.
God bless you. That's a wonderful statement to make.
I appreciate all that you've done. I'm not at all surprised by the feedback that you've gotten from your book. When you think about all the roles that you've had, from teacher to advisor to mentor to the businesses that you've run to the EY things that you've done globally, all the people that you've worked with, I'm not surprised at all. I got a lot from the book. I highly recommend it to everybody else. I will be promoting it to the best that I can. Congratulations on another job well done. And I'm really excited to continue our conversations and to keep learning from you.
Absolutely. I rock on, Michael.
Have a great night. We'll talk to you soon.
And as we say in Gaelic, Ichiwa, which is good night.
Good night, sir. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Oreg, thank you for another tremendous conversation. If you left it up to me, I would have kept you up all night Irish time to keep that conversation going. I truly appreciate all the time that you take to share your expertise, your experience, and pour into other people. Your example of leadership, mentorship, and even friendship needs to be commended and hopefully emulated by so many others. Thank you. It's truly appreciated. We could recap that entire conversation, but to pick out a few things, I love how you talked about the power of mindfulness and different ways we can all achieve it. I was blown away to learn more about the time you took to create a PhD on yourself. Taking that time to be that introspective, that curious of who you are, wanting to get an understanding, that deep of an understanding of who you are, so you can better serve and impact others, is nearly unheard of, especially at the top of the org chart. That is another tremendous example that we can all learn from and follow. And your line, businesses don't grow, people don't grow, is not only true, but it's striking and should cause us all to pause and reflect. Porrig, thank you so much. I can't wait till the next time we see each other. Thank you. And thank you to everybody that took the time to join this conversation. Hopefully you were taking notes. Hopefully some of your perspectives have been reframed. And hopefully and shamelessly, you're out ordering his book right now, because I highly recommend it. Before you go, please take a moment to like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show. We truly appreciate you being here week after week. And while you're here, take a look at the show notes and go check out our sponsors. Humantel.com is where you can find the scientific-backed training to understand what people are likely thinking and feeling by recognizing shifts in their emotions through their facial expressions and body language. While you're there, enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice. Professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to learn not only what you can get from, but what you can contribute to the International Association of Interviewers. That's also where you can learn how to qualify for, prepare for, and then leverage the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation once you earn it. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com, where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to unlock the hidden confessions hiding in their high-impact conversations. Thank you once again. We'll see you next time. Please stay safe. Take care of each other.